do?
It's meant a place to breathe, an oxygen cylinder in the world, which is sort of metaphorically dying of COVID for many years. It's been a place where you can be sure that that you will be met with facts, with intelligence, and with courage.
The great writer Arundhati Roy speaking to us from her home in New Delhi, India. On Thursday, we'll spend the hour with Noam Chomsky, and on Friday, we'll look back at 25 years of Democracy Now! To see our interview with Ed Snowden, go to democracynow.org. Be safe in this new year. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
The Portland area is facing winter weather conditions and expected to last between December 25th and January 3rd. Multnomah County has declared a state of emergency and is opening emergency winter shelters. Members of the public can take online training and then volunteer for shifts at one of the five warming centers in different parts of Portland. Please look out for your houseless neighbors and help spread the word about the warming shelters, which will open December 25th at 3 p.m. and remain open 24 hours a day during the severe weather. More information and links to sign up to volunteer at warming centers, as well as flyers to print out, can be found at the website multco.us/cold. That's multco.us/cold.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, winter weather in the Portland metro area will bring snow to the region again tonight. COVID-19 cases in Oregon spike as the Omicron variant continues to spread rapidly, and a federal judge rules that Proud Boy leaders must face indictment charges stemming from the U.S. Capitol attack. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 29th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The Arctic air fueling Portland's week of cold and snowy weather is expected to deliver one more dose of snow before a slight warm-up returns most of the snow to the mountains. According to the National Weather Service, forecasters say they expect snow accumulation between 1 and 3 inches for most of the Portland metro area. The snow won't last long, as a light warm-up should turn the precipitation into rain by late Thursday morning. For places such as Detroit and the Cascade Foothills, a winter weather advisory starting Thursday calls for 3 to 7 inches of snow, while higher pass levels could see 6 to 12 inches. Long-term forecasts show Oregon staying in a cool and wet pattern for the next 8 to 14 days. The Multnomah County Medical Examiner's Office confirmed Tuesday that a resident of the county died from exposure to the weather on Christmas Day. Temperatures in the Portland metro area were in the mid to low 40s on that day. 76-year-old Henry Steele was found dead by Portland police officers 2 days after going missing on his way home from the Veterans Administration Hospital in Southwest Portland. Steele's niece, Christine Layton, said her uncle was in the early stages of dementia and lived in Southeast Portland with his brother. A TriMet Lyft bus was scheduled to pick up Steele at the VA hospital and take him home, but Layton said her uncle boarded a number 8 bus instead and never arrived home. Layton said her father, Steele's brother, called Portland police Tuesday to report him missing, and their family and friends spent the next 2 days searching for him. Portland police called Layton's father Saturday afternoon to say they found Steele's body lying in the bushes near the Portland Inn off Northeast Columbia and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevards. There have been no other hypothermia deaths reported in Multnomah County during the recent cold snap. According to medical experts, a person whose body heat has dropped due to cold weather exposure may not be able to think clearly or move well. Symptoms of hypothermia can appear similar to symptoms of impairment from drugs and alcohol. The county urged people to call for help if they see someone outside who appears impaired and not dressed for the weather. People can call 211 to help someone find shelter or arrange for transportation there, or call the county's non-emergency line to request a welfare check for someone. The county said anyone who sees someone outside who appears to be in medical crisis should call 911. Multnomah County has opened multiple emergency warming shelters, and TriMet is free for anyone needing a ride to a shelter. COVID-19 cases have spiked in Oregon, with new cases reported in 35 counties. The Oregon Health Authority reported another 1,900 new cases on Tuesday. Oregon health officials also announced 8 new deaths. Hospital beds continue to be mostly filled around the state. Overall, only 9% of adult ICU beds are available, while only 8% of adult non-ICU beds are open. In Portland, outside the Oregon Convention Center, many people waited in line for 2 hours in near-freezing temperatures and snow to get a COVID-19 test. At the Portland Expo Center, OHSU's drive-through testing site was closed Wednesday and will remain closed all week because of the weather. Many stores in the area have sold out of at-home COVID tests as demand for them has spiked during the holidays. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said on Tuesday that all the 50 states are in the red zone of high COVID transmission. With an average of over 267,000 new cases of COVID-19 reported in the last 7 days, the U.S. broke its previous record set in January of this year. The Omicron variant accounts for 59% of new infections, more than double the previous week's number. Hospital cases are also rising, and there has been a sharp rise in children hospitalized due to COVID. The World Health Organization said Tuesday that the number of COVID cases recorded worldwide increased by 11% last week compared from the previous week. This comes as the WHO marks exactly 2 years since it was first alerted to an outbreak of an illness in Wuhan, China, that would eventually come to be known as COVID-19. A pause on residential mortgage foreclosures in Oregon will expire on Friday. This leaves the future uncertain for homeowners who have missed loan payments during the pandemic. The Oregon legislature has twice approved a moratorium on foreclosures for missed payments, once in 2020 and again in May of 2021. Both times, lawmakers gave Governor Kate Brown the authority to extend the moratorium only through the year's end. Brown said that starting January 1st, homeowners may be expected to resume mortgage payments and indicate how they intend to make up earlier missed payments. She urged homeowners at risk of foreclosure to take advantage of state resources such as free housing counseling or to speak directly with mortgage lenders about foreclosure prevention programs. Federally backed mortgages, which represent the majority of U.S. home loans, were protected by federal rules that prevented lenders from foreclosing without offering repayment options, but those also expire on December 31st. According to a U.S. Census Bureau survey conducted earlier this month, about 45,000 Oregon households are behind on mortgage payments. 2021 saw two high-profile convictions of Minnesota police officers charged with murder or manslaughter. A statewide accountability group says those results are still the exception, and it's doing more direct work with law enforcement to avoid deadly encounters in the future. Mike Moen has the story.
This month's guilty verdict in the Kim Potter trial has brought renewed attention to police accountability. But a Minnesota group says fatal encounters with law enforcement still happen too often, and it wants to help departments with their response teams. Potter, a former Brooklyn Center officer, was convicted in the shooting death of Dante Wright. It followed this spring's conviction of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Michelle Gross of Communities United Against Police Brutality says those verdicts are important for the families, but the need for reform is far from over. Her group's current focus is to help departments embrace alternative responses to calls.
What we need to do is narrow the bandwidth of policing to those things that police are supposed to be doing, which is, you know, crime.
She says it's been frustrating trying to get certain reform measures adopted by the legislature, but her group cites a victory this year. A new law requires 911 dispatchers to route mental health calls to crisis teams. Gross says it won't be easy for every jurisdiction to implement the changes, and advocacy groups have pledged to help them overcome logistical barriers. Beyond the law change, Gross says there are broader efforts to help some cities build a more robust response network of specialists. At the same time, she feels it's important to not strip communities of law enforcement capability.
We do need police when a crime has occurred, and people have access to the court system by way of a police investigation.
As for the Potter verdict, Gross says it proves video footage adds another dimension in analyzing deadly encounters with police. She suggests it allows juries and the public to better question police accounts of whether an individual posed a threat, especially in situations where racial profiling is a possibility. I'm Mike Moen reporting.
A federal judge on Tuesday refused to dismiss an indictment charging four alleged leaders of the far-right group, the Proud Boys, with conspiring to attack the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
A federal judge refused to dismiss an indictment against four alleged Proud Boys leaders related to the January attack on the U.S. Capitol. Four men, Ethan Nordine, Zachary Rell, Joseph Biggs, and Charles Donahoe, were charged with obstructing an official proceeding and conspiring to attack the Capitol to prevent Congress from certifying Joe Biden's presidential victory. U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly heard and rejected defense attorney arguments that the men were exercising their First Amendment rights to free speech. The judge said, in a 43-page ruling, that the defendants had nonviolent ways to express their feelings about the 2020 presidential election. While the lawyers also stated congressional certification of the Electoral College result is not an official proceeding, Judge Kelly disagreed with that as well. Representative Liz Cheney recently questioned whether former President Trump may also face charges from trying to obstruct Congress from certifying Biden's results. The obstruction statute has been cited in approximately 200 recent cases, and many rulings, including some by Trump-appointed district court judges, have been supportive. The Justice Department has launched a far-reaching investigation of the January 6th Capitol attack. Federal authorities have identified more than three dozen people in the siege as being associated with the Proud Boys. Nordine, Rell, and Donahoe were Proud Boys chapter presidents, while Biggs was a self-described Proud Boys organizer. On January 6th, Proud Boys members met at the Washington Monument, marched to the Capitol, and according to the indictment, breached barriers at the pedestrian entrance. More than 700 people have now been charged with federal crimes related to the Capitol riot. Some have been members of other right-wing groups, including the Oath Keepers. In the ruling, Kelly stated, quote, "Even if the charged conduct had some expressive aspect, it lost whatever First Amendment protection it may have had," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A partisan review of Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election won't meet its original December 31st deadline. The leaders of the review say the taxpayer-funded process will continue into 2022, and they attribute the expanded timeline to challenges from Democrats and the Wisconsin Attorney General. Jonah Chester has the story.
A partisan review of Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election was going to wrap up this week, but the leaders of the investigation say they need more time to complete the process. Republican leaders blame the missed deadline in part on Attorney General Josh Call, who sued in October to block subpoenas, arguing the investigators are overstepping their legal boundaries. Call argues the subpoenas for Megan Wolf, the state's top election official, and the Wisconsin Elections Commission are overly broad and unenforceable. But in a hearing on December 23rd, Attorney James Bopp said the investigators have the full authority of the legislature.
The legislature has plenary authority to make sure that these people administer the law properly.
The AG also says the investigators can't compel public officials to testify privately, that they should appear publicly before a legislative committee. The taxpayer-funded probe received about $680,000 for a contract ending December 31st. Legislative Republicans haven't yet announced how much more money the project will receive or its potential end date. The investigation has drawn criticism from voting rights groups, open government advocates, and legislative Democrats. It's even a divisive issue within the Wisconsin GOP. Republican Senator Kathleen Bernier, chair of the Senate Committee on Elections, has accused the investigation leader, former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman, of spreading misinformation and undermining a bedrock of the electoral process.
when Benjamin Franklin came out of the convention and our Constitution was created, he was asked, what kind of a government do we have? And he said, a republic if we can keep it. We're in jeopardy of losing it.
The mayors of Wisconsin's five largest cities have also been subpoenaed. At least two have refused to testify behind closed doors. Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway and Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich. In response, Gableman is filing a separate suit to force private interviews. A hearing on that case is set for January 21st. A decision on the other subpoenas is expected by January 10th. This is Jonah Chester reporting.
You are listening to an end of your membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview about Catherine Ross's new book, A Right to Lie, Presidents, Other Liars, and the First Amendment, followed by Noise Filter, debunking myths about the COVID-19 pandemic. Tonight's weather will be snowy with a low of 31 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with mixed with some snow and a high of 41. Today in history, in 1890, 146 Sioux Native Americans are massacred at Wounded Knee by the U.S. Cavalry. Some historians say as many as 300 were killed, nearly half of them women and children. The conflict at Wounded Knee was originally referred to as a battle, but in reality it was a tragic massacre and the last major confrontation in America's deadly war against the Plains Indians. The quote of the day is from Native American Nez Perce leader Chief Joseph, who said, quote, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade where I choose, free to choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to talk, think, and act for myself." Longtime Senate leader Harry Reid passes away. Strong divides show through in views on January 6th and a congresswoman pleas for civility after a threatening message. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I love the Senate. I care about it so very, very much. I've enjoyed Congress for 34 years. As the leader here in the Senate, I've had such joy and times of, oh, wow, what are we going to do now?
Harry Reid, a once giant of the Senate, passed away on Tuesday. The 82-year-old Democrat battled pancreatic cancer. Reid served as majority leader from 2006 to 2014 before retiring from politics in 2017. Reid worked to muster the support of all Democratic senators to pass the Affordable Care Act under President Barack Obama. In his 30 years in the Senate, Reid was known as one of the chamber's more divisive leaders, once calling then-President George W. Bush a liar and colleague Mitt Romney a tax cheat. However, during a farewell speech, political rival Mitch McConnell noted the common ground he found with Reid.
It's clear that Harry and I have two very different worldviews, two different ways of doing things, and two different sets of legislative priorities. But through the years, we've come to understand some things about one another, and we've endeavored to keep our disagreements professional rather than personal.
In May of 2015, prior to retirement, Reid tapped now Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to succeed him as the head Democrat in the Senate. A poll published Tuesday found a strong partisan divide over how people view federal efforts to arrest and try people accused of participating in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The poll from the University of Massachusetts Amherst showed about 30% of Republicans supported those efforts, compared to 86% of Democrats. It also found about 70% of Republicans said President Joe Biden's victory was illegitimate, with most attributing the belief to fraudulent ballots. Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell of Michigan is voicing concerns after a voicemail she received threatened violence against her family.
Kinds of nasty messages, nasty comments, just nasty how people can be sometimes. And it's hard.
Dingell says it's just one of many messages she's received in recent weeks, and she's calling for civility in politics.
And maybe we could just try to treat each other a little nicer, not leave these kinds of threatening messages or go after someone. A little act of kindness is a lot better than screaming at somebody.
Dingell says authorities are investigating the threat. The U.S. hit its highest one-day total of new COVID-19 cases on Tuesday, with more than 442,000 infections, surpassing the previous daily record by close to 150,000. A CDC spokesperson said the daily case total is likely an overestimate due to lagging state reporting. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
An Oglala Lakota artist publishes his first book of art and a look back at 2021 tribal COVID vaccination efforts. With more on these stories, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A noted Oglala Lakota artist has just published his first book of art titled Visual Language, The Ledger Drawings of Dwayne Wilcox, featuring more than 50 reproductions. Victoria Wicks reports.
Dwayne Wilcox tackles many of the familiar negatives of Native life on the reservation or off: diabetes and heart disease, unemployment, suicide, addiction, rape, and disproportionate rates of imprisonment. But he's telling the story from the inside looking out, with great affection and often humor, relating stories of people he's known over his 64 years of living. This book is his first solo publication. His work is included in significant exhibits and permanent collections across the country. Yale University acquired the drawings in this book even before it was published.
They acquired the whole catalog of pictures, I think 54 of them. They purchased all 54 from me. So it's at the Beinecke Library of Rare Books and Manuscripts at Yale.
Wilcox says curators describe his worldview as if he gained it from the same perch academia sits on, rather than from inside the Native nations and societies where he resides.
I hear the word juxtaposition or irony, which is really strange because it's kind of the reversal look of the culture. It's not counterculture, but it's a reversal of a view of America from the other side. So they, you know, I hear the words like that, and it's not really that from our perspective.
Wilcox says he intends his art to help dispel the notion that Native people live in history books and instead show them as contemporary people with modern-day lives. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
This week, we're taking a look at some stories and newsmakers of 2021. COVID-19 has hit tribal nations hard. American Indians and Alaska Natives have infection rates of more than 3.5 times higher than non-Hispanic whites, are more likely to be hospitalized, and have higher mortality rates, according to the Indian Health Service. Tribal leaders and health officials have worked hard to protect their communities, including embracing COVID-19 vaccines, partnering with IHS or states to receive doses. Many tribes have relied on their leaders and cultural bearers when it comes to vaccine hesitancy, as Savannah Marr reported in January.
The Northern Arapaho tribe has been hit hard by the pandemic, and many tribal members are eager to be vaccinated. That's according to Lisa Yawaking with the tribe's medical clinic.
However, there are some that do have questions.
She says clinic staff have been fielding those questions via social media, and they've been getting help from Arapaho ceremonial elders, like George Moss, who agreed to get the first shot and to have it broadcast live on Facebook.
This is for all my people, my Arapaho people.
Many tribal communities outpace their non-Native neighbors with vaccination efforts, like the Navajo Nation in February exceeded goals of administering more than 100,000 vaccines. Infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci praised tribal efforts in March.
They're doing something right, and I think that what we need to do is set that as an example and keep it up.
In May, the Indian Health Service began vaccinating ages 12 and older, and in the fall, children ages 5 to 11. IHS officials visited sites in Oklahoma in November to highlight youth vaccination. Indian Health Service Acting Director Elizabeth Fowler spoke at an event in Anadarko.
We are excited that our children can finally get vaccinated, but it's been a long journey to get here.
Caddo Nation Chairman Bobby Gonzalez.
The children are, vulnerable, and it's real important that we get our
kids vaccinated.
As of December 27th, the Indian Health Service has administered more than 2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
At 67 degrees Fahrenheit on Sunday, Kodiak, Alaska set a new high temperature record for the state in the month of December. The temperature in southern Alaska reached the 60s again on Monday before falling to 55 degrees on Tuesday morning. Brooke Thoman, a climate scientist with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy in Fairbanks, said, quote, "In late December, I would not have thought such a thing possible." This year, the average temperature for the contiguous U.S. on Christmas Day was the warmest since 1900. Alaska is generally warming faster than the rest of the U.S. and already suffers from flooding, erosion, and other signs of climate change. The recent heat wave in some parts of Alaska was driven by a mass of high-pressure air known as a heat dome that has been hovering over the northeastern Pacific Ocean. A heat dome that settled above the Pacific Northwest this summer shattered records and caused multiple heat-related deaths in Portland. Some parts of Alaska, including Fairbanks, have also experienced record amounts of rain in recent days. That's a problem in part because it will leave water on roads that could stay frozen until March. Normally, December is a dry month in interior Alaska because the typically frigid air cannot hold much moisture. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants facts, not forecasts.
The last couple of days have been warmer with less snow than predicted, and I realize the world is run the same way weather is forecast. Men with ulterior motives and little actual knowledge telling us what to think and do. We isolate, stock up, we're glued to our screens, our earbuds, we get almost no direct experience. Maybe the shelves at the new supermarket should be three-quarters empty because there's so little factual news, while the shelves by the checkout counters are overflowing with opinions and speculation, junk food and eye candy. It's not that we can't handle the truth, but that we might not be so easy to handle, to manipulate, if we had the truth, if we knew how little the rich and powerful cared about us. We're not people, we're markets. Go out and experience the weather, fresh, unrecycled air. Talk to friends and neighbors. Get your own facts. I get headaches when my brain's recycling bin is too stuffed with official opinions. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Mullen, and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio, bringing you news and views on local, national, and international policies that affect us all. At 9, we'll hear Radio Zine, which features a variety of intriguing public affairs programming. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints Investigative News with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Words and Pictures, presenting The Art of the News, a new museum exhibition showcasing comic journalists from around the world. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview about Catherine Ross's new book, Our Right to Lie, Presidents, Other Liars, and the First Amendment. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The late independent journalist I.F. Stone said that governments lie. They lie just like we breathe. That's just what they do. George Washington University law professor Catherine Ross has written a book about lying called A Right to Lie: Presidents, Other Liars, and the First Amendment. The book talks about the constitutional status of lies, why it's so hard to regulate political lies, and former President Donald Trump's lies about the coronavirus and the stolen election. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about what a lie is, how the Supreme Court has weighed in on the issue, and where Trump fits into the story.
I.F. Stone was a wonderful social and political commentator, and certainly he said that, and ever since at least the Vietnam War and probably before, people of my generation understood that governments lie. But there is, I think, a difference between the government when it speaks and a particular individual, even if he is what is in essence the CEO of the government, and when he speaks as an individual rather than issuing a State Department policy or a summary of what's going on the battlefield.
Because they do want to hide things.
They definitely want to hide things. And there are legal scholars who focus on lies by the government as such. My interest was more in lies by individuals, starting not so much with government officials, but I became interested in this topic in 2012 when the Supreme Court, for the first time, confronted the question of whether the First Amendment protects the right to tell a lie. And there are two ways of framing what a lie is. And I'm talking about verifiable factual falsehoods that can be disproven, that blatant lies, what I call bald-faced or aggressive.